In 2017, opioid addiction claimed nearly 50,000 American lives. That's as many Americans as were lost in the entire Vietnam War, and more than were lost to gunshots and automobile accidents combined. Today's guests explore the history of opium from antiquity to the modern world and describe a solution to the opioid crisis that blends an understanding of what works and what has failed previously. They are Dr. John Helpern and David Blistein this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to A Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, filmmakers, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by two great guests. John Helpern, MD, is a psychiatrist in private practice who previously served as medical director of the Boston Center for Addiction Treatment. And David Blistein is an award-winning documentary filmmaker whose credits include the PBS documentary The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science. Together, they are co-authors of an important new book, Opium: How an Ancient Flower Shaped and Poisoned Our World. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for giving us a chance to be here and talk about this stuff.
So, you know, the poppy is a flower, yep. But it's this incredibly potent and powerful flower across human history. Where was it first grown, and how did it become so important?
The first relics of it being grown are in Neolithic times, sort of throughout Europe, mostly in the area of like Austria, Hungary, and also over in Spain. There are poppy seed pods and seeds can be found in burial sites and other sites there. So they had it. It's hard to know what they were doing with it, but burial sites gives you a hint.
Are there best guesses about what they were doing with it?
Well, it's, you know, like the original painkiller. I mean, it doesn't take much to get a little bit of poppy juice on a wound and realize, oh, this feels better. This is good. Things are better. So one assumes this is a painkiller. It could be, it's a source of protein also.
These poppies were, you know, they're not even found in the wild anymore. They're only grown through cultivation. So they're identified in Neolithic times before history, and they've been woven then through the fabric of civilization since the beginning.
And was its appeal always, I'm going to say, medicinal?
The primary purpose for it was medicinal, but it took on other importance also. So it was used to help people also in their final exit, people dying. But it was also given en masse to militaries sometimes. So Alexander the Great had most of his army on opium while they were on the march.
And why was that? What was the benefit?
Less pain. Less pain from the march and also dealing with any wounds.
So you could keep marching even if you were injured or your feet hurt or whatever.
And people, you know, there's controversy about that. And he had seven major wounds, okay? He was in the poppy growing district, right? He was probably an alcoholic. And people say, well, we don't have any proof he did opium. Well, it was aspirin then. We don't have any proof that, you know, people did aspirin at certain times. And that's what had that kind of controversy that just seems silly when you start looking at it.
So in addition to killing pain relief, what were some of the other ancient uses for opium?
Well, it's interesting because the Sumerians referred to it by a symbol that was translated as the joy plant. But of course, it's not clear whether the joy came from not having your pain or the joy came from some kind of narcotic effect.
It may also have been woven through like the Eleusinian mysteries. So it was also part of a sacrament in some ancient religions.
So was it grown throughout Europe? My crude understanding is it was from Turkey and Iraq originally. I mean,
yeah, and there was some. It was grown a little bit, not much further north than that. That's why it's interesting that in that Swiss area is where it first appeared, because that's not where it became cultivated in quantity. But
so to get from where it was grown to where it was used, there was trade. So there was profit of some kind, money to be made of some kind, and simply in making it a business. I mean, we'll get to today's equivalents, as it were, but is that not true? It was a business.
If you look at the ancient ampuras, so the Greeks were the great merchants, you know, of the ancient world, and they did a lot of symbolism for communication, because they're not going to know every language, right? So if you look at an ampura, a large vessel that wine would be put in, you know, there's beautiful drawings around it, and then that's an object of trade. And these, we find them, you know, archaeologically, we find them in galleys that have sunk to the ocean and stuff. Well, if you turn one of those ampuras upside down, it's perfectly the shape of an opium poppy. And so things of ancient times, the fortified wines, it's mentioned in the Bible and elsewhere, what were they fortified with? Well, one of the key things it was fortified with was opium.
So is it clear when an additional use for it beyond medicinal, beyond pain relief, beyond using it to suppress or address cough, and it became pleasurable, meaning to get a high? Is there any indication of when that happened?
So it becomes recreational.
Recreational, yeah, exactly. Well, recreational use of
again
of
the
drug
plant, but also story we tell is that Marcus Aurelius, the famous Stoic emperor of Rome, got to a point where he needed maintenance doses. He was very disciplined, so he needed maintenance doses of opium that were provided to him by a guy named Galen, who was one of the most famous doctors in history.
Course, yeah.
So, you know, in there, and those Greek kids were doing a lot of stuff. Greek and Roman kids were doing a lot of stuff. It's not quite clear what, but it was part of the culture. By Alexander's time, for sure.
So with the rise of recreational use then, were there also concerns about its overuse then? Because we think of opium as this incredibly addictive substance. Was that understood in ancient times?
Go ahead.
I just think we didn't get ahead of our public health for that to be a legitimate consequence that people that are looking at greater populations than just their own family would recognize that there's a problem here. So people are dying much younger. Also, you know, we have no vaccines, we have no medicines primarily back then, and we have one medicine that can truly help alleviate pain. So primarily it was reserved for this important use. The idea that we would have an abundance of material available for recreational purposes and that would then, you know, spread like wildfire through the population, it just wasn't, we weren't evolved enough then to be able to do something like that.
In ancient times, that's absolutely true. But we move into the modern era, and now you've got nations and you've got massive corporations that are built around the opium trade. Am I right?
You're correct.
Right. You want us to skip 2,000 years there?
We'll jump around a little bit.
I'll give you a handoff place. Around 1,000, which is interesting, around 1,000, 1,100, 1,200. It was, I mean, someone wrote a whole book about it back then, about opium, about using it in medicine and so on. And around that time, Moses Maimonides, famous Jewish philosopher, insisted that you have to give, it's almost a sin not to give opium to a dying person. You have to provide it if they can't afford it. At the same time, over in Persia, a guy named Avicenna was experimenting. He was trying to find a replicable dose. He was realizing that depending on where you grew it, it was stronger or it was weaker. So they were studying this stuff. They knew it. Recreational, you know, it really got serious when the Portuguese started dropping it into their tobacco pipes. But that's that's another leap of 500, 600 years.
Yep.
But that's when we really know it got recreational.
So chapter 8 of your book is Marco Polo and the Rise of Global Commerce. What was the role of Marco Polo in the opium trade and in the proliferation of distribution of opium?
Well, you know, he was obviously important in a lot of trade on the Silk Road. And what's interesting is that China then, opium was part of their pharmacopoeia for thousands of years.
China,
maybe going back 2000. To 2000 BC, 3000 BC.
Okay, so it was widely used there, and
but
not just
very
in
small,
ancient
but
Greece.
The opium wasn't grown there, wasn't as strong, and it was just one of those ingredients used. Now, when Marco Polo started coming over, then you started getting the trade between what we call Afghanistan now, or Iran, Iraq, and so on. and China. So it's just the beginning of it starting to, it's a great coin. You got gold, you got silver, you got drugs. They're all small, they're all really valuable. So from the beginning, you know, just like they used any spice in the East, you know, other spices were very, very valuable.
So when did America get into the opium business? We tend to think of it, we're going to talk a lot about that. We tend to think of it as a more modern situation, and particularly with OxyContin and so forth. But so when did America get in?
The Shakers grew it, right?
They grew it.
The Shakers grew it.
Grew it here.
Grew it in New Lebanon. That community grew it, and they had, they
provided. New Lebanon, New Hampshire.
No, that's New Lebanon.
Pennsylvania?
Hancock, no, Massachusetts, New York.
Okay,
that
yeah,
area,
yeah,
the
yeah.
Berkshires. And they used it in a remedy they call Pain King. The emperor of all, not the emperor, of all painkillers. They grew it, some other, a lot of doctors experimented with it. It was grown near my hometown of Putney, Vermont. And they were doing it because they wanted to grow it here. They wanted homegrown because it was expensive to get it from Turkey, and they hate being relying on the British, right? But it was a major painkiller. In the Revolutionary War, they grew some in the Connecticut Valley for the soldiers. Wow. So again, it came in as a painkiller. Always comes in as a way to deal with pain.
One of the most fascinating eras in history to me is the era of the Opium Wars in Asia, yeah, where the British government and the and British corporations are they're basically using opium as a weapon of war.
Yep.
We have to include the United States in
that. Yeah, that's right.
We also felt left out. And so we were one of the major powers that also got involved with the selling of opium to Imperial China. So back then, the mixing of opium with tobacco to that, something that's called smoking opium, this addicted half to two-thirds of all of China.
You write about addiction becoming a problem in the United States. And that was in the 19th century, not the 20th century and 21st century. When it began, obviously it still is. Talk about that.
One of the big things was after the Civil War, because it was used so extensively as a painkiller.
Oh, for war wounds.
So yeah. You really get this exactly the same thing as post-Vietnam heroin. You
know, was there anything else used to relieve pain in the Civil War era? Was there anything else?
It absolutely was opium-based pain control.
Yeah. And they had
and like you'd see, I guess, on some like corny Western, open up a bottle of whiskey until the guy gets knocked out and is just delirious and stuporously unaware.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to catch up with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guests this week are John H. Halpern, M.D., a psychiatrist in private practice with extensive experience in the treatment of addiction, and David Blistein, an award-winning documentary filmmaker. Together, they are co-authors of a new history of one of the great contemporary scourges of American life. The book is titled Opium, How an Ancient Flower Shaped and Poisoned Our World. Dr. Halpern isn't on Twitter, but you can find David Blistein there. He's at David Blistein, B-L-I-S-T-E-I-N.
So you have a generation that fought the Civil War.
Yep. Yeah.
And is that where addiction began to be a problem, and not just for some of these veterans, but also for the general population?
I think alcoholism, right, has always been a big problem. I mean, even the term to be at loggerheads, right, it comes from the British seeing colonists arguing and jousting with a loggerhead used to make a kind of hot toddy. Rum flip was the most popular drink of the colonial era, and it required a loggerhead to warm it. But they would see these guys get drunk and start kind of like jousting at each other. So it's always been, I think, public intoxication problems with addiction since the founding
of our country. I'm referring specifically, though, to addiction to opium.
Civil War era was a defining time for our country, and the amount of upheaval and the also the vast quantities of wounded soldiers that could survive and the amputations that occurred, without a doubt, it would have been an even more horrific history without opium. On the other side, there's the first generation of people then aware of its addictive potential in mass.
So if you're a veteran, and this is a good thing for you, you're not living in screaming agony your entire life.
Right.
But if you're somebody else who is perhaps using it recreationally, there's a different hazard and peril there.
Well, right? You know, it's interesting because there's a whole book about, called The Green Mountain Opium Eaters. So there's a whole book about people doing opium in the 1800s. And I think then,
maybe Green Mountain meaning Vermont?
Vermont, yeah. And maybe because they didn't care so much about lifespan, maybe, but the productivity was a worry. But the really interesting thing about late 1800s, people started worrying about addiction, is when high-class Victorian men and women are getting addicted in San Francisco on the opium that the Chinese immigrants were trying to build a railroad or had a lot of pain were doing. And that's when people started getting worried. It's just like today. When people like us start getting addicted, suddenly the middle class in America and upper class gets concerned. Suddenly it's a problem.
So how are they getting their opium? Smoking it, is that correct? How are they ingesting it?
I mean, it's primarily smoking, but you could also eat it. And
you could buy it, right?
You don't
need a prescription or anything like that.
It was laudanum. It was in with alcohol, which has been around
Lydia Pinkham's, didn't that have...
What's that?
Lydia Pinkham's. Pain
there were so many.
There's
of them.
So many patent medicines, and they often contained, you know, Loudly. Tinctures of opium, or from cannabis, or even from cocaine.
So, as the awareness of the challenge of the addictive quality of opium begins to emerge in America, when does it become sort of when does it get the attention of public health officials as addiction is something that needs to be addressed, and therapies need to be designed?
I think it's with the Transcontinental Railroad. Because you had a lot of racism towards Chinese immigrants that were building these railroads, and they brought along with them smoking opium, which then got sold out to others. And then there's a lot of popular writing about this, as well as then this kind of xenophobia restriction of trying to prevent these people from emigrating to the United States.
So drug laws began to be passed in the first part of the 20th century. What were they, and what was the intent?
California had a few around 1870 because they felt they really had a problem because it was coming from.
And what did the laws do?
They closed down opium houses, smoke houses, and stuff. They played around the edges like we do today.
Import taxes.
That's how they did it. And then in 1914, the first national law was passed. It was called the Harrison Act, but it was really just a tax act. It didn't outlaw it. It outlawed selling it without a prescription, or you had to be licensed to do it. The first real national law against using it was in the early 20s, around the same time as Prohibition. But they didn't get serious about it until the vigilantes, as it were, had nothing to deal with after Prohibition, so they had to like really start cracking down on opium.
So we've had more so-called drug wars since then, under later presidents, for example.
Where should we start?
I mean, you know, it's sometimes it's directly part of the story, and sometimes it's indirectly, right? So we know with Vietnam, there was large percentages of our soldiers that got addicted, and then interestingly enough, when they came stateside, they would stop. And then, but the addiction didn't follow them. So literally, learned that the stress of being in the field of war can be such that people will abuse all sorts of things. And then, when they're out of it, the addiction won't continue, so to say. So that's one. That's something that came out of that. But then we have more direct wars with what we've done down in Colombia and also these other programs to try to remove the plants from their territory, to clandestine operations in Southeast Asia, to more directly engaging some of these people that are bad actors on one side but helpful on the other to some of our other national agenda.
But it started in the 1600s. Chinese emperor started trying to outlaw, wage war on opium in the 1600s, and they continued to try. And they would strangle dealers, and they would lock up people. They would do the whole thing. And by when the opium wars broke out, when England said, we need something to buy tea with, that's when the so-called opium wars took place. And all the wars that the Chinese had fought since then, you look at the graph, and the amount of use goes up and up and up and up and up. Just like when Richard Nixon started us on our spending spree of $1 trillion on wars on drugs.
The war on drugs, yeah.
You know, I mean, when are people going to get it? You know, it's not about that. It's like outlawing lung cancer, diabetes. It's nuts.
One of the things that I was sort of stunned to learn was that the current opioid epidemic is taking more lives every year than gunshots and gun violence and automobile accidents combined. That's a staggering figure. But we're not talking about natural opium in most cases, right? No. We're talking about synthetic opioids. What's the difference?
So, right. Current 2019 statistics are 130 Americans are dying each and every day of an overdose. And if you look at the special congressional acts that have been passed in the current administration for, you know, providing extra funding for this these problems, $8 billion was secured for towards drug treatment from the opioid crisis. Compare that to natural disasters. It's about $120, $130 billion spent. But we've got 70,000 plus Americans dying right now from this.
What explains just the paucity of the response in comparison to the number of people who are dying?
Okay, so one has to do with who votes. Right? And we have to organize better. Another thing is it's been a stigmatizing discussion. I remember the first time somebody from the Drug Policy Alliance, Ethan Nadelman, got to have a debate on Nightline with Ed Rollins, a Republican operative, about legalization, about discussing about how to treat drug addiction differently. And all of a sudden, Henry Rollins pushes away from the table and goes, you know, merely having this discussion is a threat to national security. So that's in our lifetime. And so we went from there. It was like even taboo to just even try to talk about this to a place today where we understand that when we talk about the drug user, that's somebody's mother, father, brother, sister, daughter, son. That's part of us. We've got to stop ostracizing them and pushing them away and labeling them as the bad individual, because they're just as much in need and deserving of good medical care as any of us. And so once we can get that discussion going, then we can look at why the problem is so bad and what we can do about it. And maybe we don't want to have that discussion. If you really want to get to the heart of the problem of the drug issues, then we have to talk about childhood poverty. Then we have to talk about inequities in education in the United States that are serious, that are also very complicated to solve and very expensive. So this is a reason why this problem keeps perpetuating from one generation to the next, because it's woven through the fabric of the other major problems of our society.
And that's true, by the way, for healthcare in general. Social factors that you're talking about, the social determinants, there's no question about that. And that's an excellent point. I want to go back just for a second to the flower. The opioids that you buy legally or illegally now aren't coming from that flower. These are synthetic for the most part, I'm guessing entirely synthetic. We were talking off camera about the potency of these synthetic substances. Get into that again, because I found that absolutely stunning and horrifying.
This is where this story, the history has been repeating itself. And I think reading our book will help demystify some of the things that we're doing, that they've been tried before, and that's why they're failing us again. They've been tried before. I mean, David just mentioned that emperors were executing dealers and users a couple hundred years ago. It didn't work. But that's the same playbook that we're going to draw from. The difference today is absolutely what you said, that this problem has escaped the growth cycle, has escaped the flower, is now 100% synthetic. So fentanyl doesn't require any precursors that need to be grown from the soil. It's 100% synthetic.
In a lab.
Those precursor chemicals are not Schedule I drugs. Some of them are on the forensic watch list, some aren't, but you're not going to go to jail for the rest of your life. So you just mail the precursor chemicals into the city you want to distribute in, and then you synthesize it. What you need,
but they're incredibly potent, which means they're toxic and incredibly dangerous.
Correct. So heroin's 50, 100 times more potent than morphine. Fentanyl's about 100 times more potent than that. Carfentanil, which killed 1,000 extra people in just 1 year in Ohio when that was found on the street there, that is 10,000 times more potent than morphine.
And other drugs are laced with these substances, too, like now cocaine, for example.
Cocaine and amphetamines. So and there's some controversy about whether it can be in smokable pot because it might not, the heat might do it. But it can be in elixirs.
This is part of the public health problem, though. People who are buying what they think is cocaine are actually getting fentanyl or this other type of fentanyl that you're talking about.
In New England, any user of cocaine should be carrying a Narcan on them. Because it's just everywhere that the cocaine is laced with fentanyl because it's going to make it more addictive.
Around the country. Right.
Around the country for sure, but definitely in this region, I don't know how anybody could presume that they're not going to have fentanyl laced into their stuff.
We've got a couple of minutes left here. I'm curious, when we get down to brass tacks, what do we as a society need to be doing now? To actually get our arms around and do something about this crisis once and for all?
I'm going to tell you that everyone I talk to on the ground knows exactly what to do. Everyone that deals with addiction knows what to do. The first thing you do is decriminalize it. You don't throw people in jail for having an illness. You don't throw people in jail for having diabetes or lung cancer. That's the first thing. Second of all, you desperately need insurance parity so that you can get the same kind of level of treatment you get for addiction as you can get for heart disease or whatever. That is the top level, because down on the ground, they know we need safe injection sites. They know we need naloxone everywhere. They know we need clean needles. You go to any, drop-in center here, they know that. So it's national level we need help.
So it's larger systemic change.
Methadone still has to be through a clinic.
Right.
A doctor can prescribe it one-on-one, like Suboxone. So why are you tying doctors' hands like that? There's one thing that could change overnight that would help get more people treatment.
Do you see any progress toward this better future?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Absolutely. One, because I'm used to seeing interest in this story wax and wane with the election cycle. I was very cynical, thinking that the last presidential election, everybody's talking about it for a year and then it's going to go away. But it hasn't. And that gives me the most hope that it is still a topic of importance in this country, and that we're talking about it differently. That gives me tremendous hope. The other one is that Sublocade, a monthly injection, came out of Suboxone. And that, I think, is a big game changer, because now we won't see Suboxone diverted to the street if we can just get more clinics prescribing it.
We're going to leave this on a hopeful note.
Okay.
So thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you.
John Halperin, MD, and David Blistein.
Good try.
Thank you so much for being with us.
From Rhode Island, we do that.
The book is Opium. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. He's Wayne. I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.